And so I think really honestly, pretty early in my life, I started really wondering and imagining, like, what is fullness of life and what does Jesus have to do with that? There was something unique about the sacred story that I was a part of and this community of people who loved me no matter what and this God who loved me no matter what.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Have you ever been admonished to endure to the end? We often think of religious life as a struggle, or it's described as a grand battle. But what if we thought of religious life as an opportunity to thrive? My grandmother spent her last year of life being cared for by my parents in her home. About a month before she died, as she was lying in a hospital bed my parents had rented to make her comfortable, my mother asked her, "What should I do with these pennies in the windowsill?" My grandmother explained, "Those are my service pennies. Whenever I do an act of service, I move them across the windowsill from one side to the other. I try to do 10 acts a day. I can still call people in the neighborhood who need cheering up and write notes to people from my church." She was finding joy in those small acts, even as she was slipping into the next life. Is that what enduring looks like? Or is that better described as thriving? Today we speak with Pamela Epstein King from the Fuller School of Theology, where she's the Peter L. Benson Professor of Applied Developmental Science and the Executive Director of the Thrive Center for Human Development. Her primary research interests lie at the intersection of thriving and spiritual development.
I'm captivated by human transformation and hopefully growth and thriving and joy and these good things. And I find university students, college students, grad students asking such big, great questions around meaning and seeking questions around identity and belonging, and also really being intentional about creating skills for contribution. That it's just such a fervent time of life. I've just really been drawn to coming alongside, teaching, pastoring, caring for, mentoring, doing research on that age group. So
it seems to me that it takes a particular kind of love that every year you may get some of the same questions and not just roll your eyes like, oh, this again, but you think, aha, they've arrived at this point.
Yes. I've never thought of it that way, but that's great. That is true. It is always feels like a privilege to come alongside students in asking those questions, because it's just wonderful to wrestle very personally with students. I very much enjoy that.
Now, because you live in Pasadena, I have to ask about the fires.
Yes, you do.
And this has affected your very area.
Yes, it has. It has been extraordinarily humbling. I have my home, my street. We only had one crushed car by a tree and other fallen trees, but which was nothing compared to 2 miles away from my home, where square miles of homes and churches and congregations and schools and businesses have been eradicated. So just seeing on the horizon black plumes of smoke going up, knowing that was a house blocks away, that just seeing something completely annihilated is really, it's very overwhelming.
It gets first billing on the news, the main slot. But can I ask spiritually about this? Because I can see people saying, "Oh, I'm so grateful to God. Our home was spared. Our prayers were answered." And that's such a hard phrase to hear if your house is now gone, as we were praying too.
Exactly. So things like, "Oh, we're so blessed that our house is saved." That's a really hard phrase for me right now, because does that mean most of my friends whose homes weren't saved or whose homes are still standing but are so smoke impacted they probably will not be able to return to them, are they not blessed? I don't think so. This has been a very good moment to update my theology on God's presence, and I've really, really had to remind myself and re-embrace that God is with us no matter what is happening. And that doesn't mean our houses don't burn, but God is with us even in that grief and loss. And it makes you appreciate as a human being how meaningful homes are and the significance of material space. I've often thought we're above that material thing, but it's made me realize that spaces which are imbued with memories and relationships and history and experiences really are vessels of meaning for us. And when you have whole neighborhoods that are interwoven with interactions and history, when those are gone, that space that was like the loom on which those, that meaning in those relationships were knitted together, that I don't know how that gets recreated.
If they need to learn about thriving and spirituality, yeah, we know someone they can talk to. This is your research, mm-hmm, about thriving and spirituality. Mm-hmm. Where did you first put these things together? Because I think of developing a spiritual life, mm-hmm, but then thriving, how are they different?
Great question.
And complementary?
Right. I'll say where it began for me is I grew up in a Presbyterian church in the Midwest. We had a basement. And of course, they put the teenagers in the basement. And I just remember sitting on some used old couch with my youth group and my pastor talking about John 10:10, about Jesus saying, I've come that you might have life in its fullness. And I was like, that sounds good. What the heck does that mean? And literally, that was the 80s. And over the years, I've seen different interpretations of fullness or abundance. Yeah. If it's prosperity and finance and success, or if it's meaning or connection or relationship with God. And so I think really honestly, pretty early in my life, I started really wondering and imagining, like, what is fullness of life? And what does Jesus have to do with that? And I am one who observed and experienced, like, wow, life is great in my high school. I was really engaged and we were Titans and I loved being a Titan and the big story about being a Titan. But there was something unique about the sacred story that I was, mm-hmm, a part of and this community of people who loved me no matter what and this God who loved me no matter what.
And you believed that when you heard it?
I believed
that. You felt it?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. And so over the years, I just kept wondering, reflecting, and then beginning to intellectually chase, what does fullness mean? And then curiosity, like, how do we come into that? I wanted to say get it, but I don't think it's something we get. I think it's something we receive. It's a very reciprocal, our relationship with God and how we interact with God through our faith community, through our spiritual practices, through our vocation and calling is something that's quite dynamic.
Do you find faith communities that you may visit or that you hear about, mm-hmm, sometimes don't know how they could increase thriving in community?
Mm-hmm. I ended up going into ministry right after college. I studied psychology at Stanford, ended up pursuing a master's of divinity, pursuing ordination, and then ended up having so many questions in psychology, I ended up doing a PhD in marriage and family studies and was really obsessed with human development in the context of systems, whether it's family system or cultural or religious system. I started to develop this lens of seeing people both psychologically and understanding spiritual journeys, like what is happening from a psychological perspective. Yeah. And then what's the theology? So when I go to churches or faith communities, I'm really struck how if they could use psychology to understand how people could thrive and become more full of life, it would really help their faith experience.
Is that something you could pick maybe a person who's a conglomeration or maybe a particular person and talk about that process that you've seen or they've someone might experience?
One of my earlier studies was actually studying young people, mm-hmm, around the world who were nominated for living with profound spirituality in their culture. So I had kids in Mumbai, Nairobi, Lima, Beirut, Northern Ireland, England, the United States. These were interviews that were conducted in person. These people actually really became inspirations for understanding the psychology of spiritual development. And what I observed across these young people, and they were very different faith traditions, like Sikh, you know, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, agnostic, Jewish believing in God, atheist, Buddhist, humanistic, like melting pot of a little bit of this and a little, uh-huh, bit of that. And actually, I'll hold up the little bit of this, little bit of that guy. He came from Minnesota. He had a Catholic grandfather, and he had a Buddhist mentor in high school. And there was a Jewish strain in his family as well. But this young man started experiencing early in his life through volunteer service that he and the kids in Guatemala that he was working with or, mm-hmm, serving were really similar. And I just remember him saying, I just have more iPods than they do. Like, this is back in the day
the
of iPods.
Difference.
Yeah, but like, we all play hacky sack. We all want friends. We all want belonging. And he was really remarkable in that he discovered the sense of purpose early on. Now, what also was interesting about him was he had profound experiences in nature and profound cross-cultural experiences that really challenged him to say, there's more. There's more yeah. than this material world. This is much easier for probably you and I to do in the context of religion because we have beliefs about a God and who Jesus is, but he didn't. So he had to work really hard to make sense of the beliefs about transcendence and what gave him meaning. And he actually talked about, he said his Judaism was like the pie shell, but he put all these different beliefs in, but he worked really hard to understand what he thought about transcendence and meaning and our obligation to one another. And for him, a whole moral code came out of this, of how he needed to act and care for people. And that's so profound because there's so many religious people who are handed behavioral beliefs and rules.
Here's the checklist.
Here's the checklist. And that becomes faith for them, is the checklist, or it becomes resentful. But this young man at 17 really wove together this belief system, extracted an ethical code, and he lived it out. He actually went and served people. And in that service, he became even more mindful of the bigness and vastness of this world that he felt called to serve. So it's this beautiful cycle of like transcendence, identity, and action.
My wife had an experience that made her wonder the same thing you're talking about. She was with this group in West Africa. They were building a school, organizing a music program, and she loved the people she met. And when she came home, everybody was asking her, didn't it make you just so grateful for everything you have? And she was surprised that her honest answer was, no, I want to know how to be as happy as they are without all those things. I see this. You've just applied it to an individual, which I think is really cool. And then we talked briefly about how a church community or a congregation or probably any group could maybe incorporate those principles. Mm-hmm. How about as a parent?
Ah, great question.
What can I do as a parent or now as a grandparent to not just say, here are the rules, as we talked about, but to actually encourage that thriving?
One thing that our culture tends to do as Westerners is they like to teach. Like, here are the beliefs and here are the rules. What we don't do awesome at is inviting young children or adolescents into like wonder and awe, that kind of emotional reverence that we experience that as adults we probably cultivate over time. But seeing the mountains and having a moment to reflect on them and reflect on the creator and express gratitude for the gift of this profound beauty. But I think we often as religious people don't invoke beauty or see the meaning of beauty or see how beauty points us to truths and to God. Also, parents, in allowing for those emotional experiences, inviting kids, like younger kids, into like imagination and telling stories. Their imagination is so ripe of like, where is God in your life? Or like letting them tell stories. It doesn't have to be absolutely accurate, but that's their language of that age. And weaving God into their stories, like where does that show up? Like, why do we pray? Yeah. Why do we do these things?
You mentioned that we might see them so often, we forget to be in awe.
Absolutely. Yeah, you get to drive up and down these roads all the time.
So tell me if this is what you're talking about. We have a little boy who's a foster child who is in our neighborhood. Great kid. So sharp. And so he comes to church and he's learning, oh, there's God. Oh, great. So they asked him, he's just 10. But for whatever reason, someone in the leadership said, would you say the opening prayer? Like, not in the kids thing, but in the big thing. He walks up to the pulpit, bows his head, and he says, hello, Heavenly Father.
Oh my gosh, so great.
And then just starts talking. And I mean, we're all a little stunned because that's not the traditional
way.
And yet I thought, wow, I just suddenly felt like God is right here with us because of how that little kid, because it's so new to him.
And that attachment to God.
Yeah.
Like it's a real relationship for him. And that's how he talks to God. And we've been so trained. But we don't necessarily bring our authentic self when we're being so formal and doing things the right way.
And it's not like we're trying to fake it. It's just that we're trying to do as it's done.
Right.
Or what?
And there was probably some great learning about how to do it. But like, so in the fire situation, I've had some exchanges with God. I'm not happy about this. I don't get it. I have felt despair, fragmentation.
Yeah.
I'm a very empathetic person, so I feel my friends lost. I feel my community's lost. I've been called to speak a lot, and I'm writing a lot and podcasting. So my job's kind of changed in the last month. I'm exhausted. But like, how do I show up that way to God and know that God embraces me and holds me in my disheveledness? And actually having moments where I think I was like so like from trauma, just in shock. My beliefs are that like even when I don't feel like I know myself, God knows me and is holding me. Mm. And I can rest and know that God has got this process.
Wow. And to be in that kind of emotional or psychological state and people saying, hey, expert, fix this for us. Talk to us. Make us feel like... Yeah.
What practice should I do? Which is awesome. And for me, it's so meaningful to be able to serve and help, be helpful and be a steward of 25 years of research and training. That action, my response, is very meaningful to me. And I just love that your church had the vision to invite this young boy to lead and serve. Mm. And so I was going to say that's something else we can do for kids is that engagement, not just have them be receivers of faith, but also enact it, volunteering, caring, speaking, leading, singing, and giving them a sense of agency and ownership of their own faith experience.
We heard in an announcement of a recent talk you gave, there was a quote. They're talking about you. He says, her theologically and psychologically informed approach to thriving involves becoming whole with and for others and God. Tell me about that.
Yes, as I mentioned, I have a background in Christian theology and also developmental psychology. So psychology is a descriptive science. We describe what is occurring. We observe things, behaviors, what happens when this boy speaks, whereas theology is more prescriptive of what should be. So when we talk about thriving, there's a lot of subjective of what's good. You know, thriving, if you look up in Webster's, thriving is like vigorous growth. So growth is good, but humans thriving, like not all growth is good growth. If I'm growing in my capacities to cheat and lie and deceive, you know, maybe in some people's worldview, that's good growth. Maybe that's resourcefulness. So whose worldview defines thriving? There's a very elaborate way in psychology to get there, that there is this need to have ongoing environments that bring out the best in people. So we need generous people who will contribute to those environments, and we need a moral and spiritual side to motivate us and guide us in that contribution. But there's also a theological approach, and I go to Christian, like Trinitarian anthropology and like a Christological anthropology. That's like, in the Bible, we're told that Jesus is the perfect image of God, and we are also told to be conformed to Christ and become more Christ-like. So there's something about thriving that has to do with becoming more like Jesus, following the ways of Christ, embodying the virtues and character strengths of Christ.
This is that difference you referred to earlier about thriving is not just, wow, I've doubled my 401k.
Right. I'm just growing up the ladder, more publications in my world. It's, I guess you could say, moral or spiritual component to it. But I also, and I don't always feel like religion gets this right, in the Bible, it's very clear that we are uniquely made, that we are fearful and wonderfully made creations, the psalm says. We all are given unique spiritual gifts in the Epistle to the Corinthians. And so, although we're called to be conformed to Christ, we're not called to uniformity. We all become like Jesus as our own selves. So if everybody on campus was like Steve, like, you'd have a lot of great podcasts, but you wouldn't have the scholars or the preachers or the... But I think often in religious circles, especially in eras, there is a pressure to conform, to behave the right way. But this gets overly prescriptive and doesn't celebrate people's uniqueness. And I often find that religious communities don't often really empower people to live into who God made them to be, to claim that. They're foibles. And but you're still trying to become like Christ. And then the third aspect in the Trinity... We understand that they're relational. So we are relational people.
Can I talk about that uniqueness or ask you
please.
About it? I don't know why. Forgive me.
No.
Mariah Carey is popping into my mind. It's not even Christmas. So a lot of young kids, just because I grew up in music, they try and sing and they think, oh, I don't sound good because I'm listening to Mariah Carey. That's good. When I open my mouth, that's not what's coming out. And it's this process where they have to figure out, I can be good at singing and not sound like whoever it might be. I don't know why Mariah Carey popped into my mind, but I don't think I completely understand that concept of there is a part of what Christ and what God wants to develop in me that is unique. And as I do that, I'm not going to be able to say, oh, good, I'm like everybody else. And other people may look at me and go, oh, is he going off the rails?
And that's part of, I think, spiritual maturity and spiritual growth is developing that internal compass mm-hmm. where you know your true north. And that's discerned with other people through your belief system and with God. Mm-hmm. But I was having a conversation with students here this morning, and a young woman was asking about, like, how do you have a family and be an academic? And I told her, like, I had to create, and it took a lot of work, and I have to keep updating it, my own internal compass that is not shared by the academy. I worked half-time most of my tenured life, and so my publication record isn't what it would have been if I had been working full-time. But I am so grateful for the opportunity of being able to spend that time with my family. Yeah. So we all have to claim who God made us to be and live into that. We have to trust that God's made us who we are for purposes that may be beyond ourselves. So becoming whole is so much to becoming your whole, unique, authentic self. The with is we're relational human beings. Theology tells us that. Psychology demonstrates that. We need others.
We die if we're alone.
We literally die if we're alone. Mm-hmm. Babies die without emotion and contact and care. And so our means of development, and I would say our ends, our goals, are relational. So I've co-written a book called The Reciprocating Self, as like the purpose of development is to become a person who is fully themselves, but fully connected with others and fully connected with God. We grow with people, with God, and for others and for God. And so that for aspect is the purpose for which we live. And that purpose is that inner compass, that true north of what are we ultimately living for. And I believe unique expression is part of that. Like, we could say, oh, we live to glorify God. But how do you, Steve, do that? How do you advance God's kingdom?
You're making me actually excited to notice what people around me are doing and thinking that is how they glorify God.
Absolutely. Okay, let me give you a lens of joy.
Uh-huh.
Start observing what brings people joy around you, like true joy, like what really delights them. And reflect on where have you experienced joy in your life? Like from the minutia of the things you do, that maybe not be the most profound enduring joy, mm-hmm. but also those beliefs, like in this fire situation, like I have to have a hopeful future, a vision for the hopeful future, and belief in God's ongoing work in this world that will redeem, that will rebuild. I have some sense of anticipation and delight about what that will be, but it's going to be really hard to get there. Yeah. But when we become aware of joy in our lives, the relationships, the connections, the activities, the work, the purposes, the beliefs, that becomes a real through line.
I see people feeling that perhaps as mm-hmm. they have banded together to accomplish mm-hmm. this thing. There are just so many ways.
Yeah. And that's where I would love to see churches and faith communities go, is like, how do we activate people into their unique purposes for a greater shared purpose?
Yeah.
And so like people coming together around a shared purpose is so powerful. To watch Pasadena, Altadena, to watch strangers, people of different socioeconomic, color of skin, walk of life, come together for a purpose of helping has been so wonderful. That doesn't want to romanticize the tragedy and catastrophe, but...
No, but it's a way to find a glimmer, I guess. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you've talked about individual journeys and ways of glorifying God. And seriously, this is this little switch you flipped in my brain. This is why you're a teacher, because I'm thinking of my kids and some different things going on with them. Mm-hmm. And they're grown-ups, mostly, occasionally.
We're still all on the journey.
We're still all there.
I'm 56. I'm still growing up.
You have talked about this, but how different environments can promote thriving for diverse people. Mm-hmm. What should we know if we want to contribute? If I've learned certain things in my own tradition, but what if I want to contribute to more than just my small tribe? Mm-hmm. How do we learn that?
So let's keep it simple. Maybe not simple. Love is never simple. But let's go back to that. Like, how do we offer love wherever we are? You hope to be helpful, to probably enable people to thrive in some, like understand life, discover more meaning, live more effectively or with more joy or have more regulation.
Yeah, and maybe even develop some empathy or love for people.
Exactly. And the reality is, like, there's so much research. Humans thrive, they become more fully alive when they live among heterogeneity, when there's diversity. When you are only with people with your perspective, you don't grow. And we get dopamine. Like, we feel good when we grow. Like, our age, we should always have a new habit. Like, it's kind of an expensive hobby, but I just love it. I don't know if you surf, but like, I'm like, okay, at 56, I need a new thing because I need to keep my brain moving. And I like the dopamine of the newness because that makes us feel good.
Yeah. I'm studying Spanish every day.
There you go.
Because a few years ago, we moved to a different part of town and at least a fifth, maybe a quarter of my neighbors all speak Spanish. And I like waving to them, but I want to ask how they are and what about your daughter? And yeah, that's been a cool thing. Okay. I'm not going fast, but I'm going.
That is a beautiful example of contributing to your environment, your neighborhood. But there you are creating empathy and connection in this physical environment of your neighborhood to create an environment that people can thrive because they matter. Yeah. They'll experience that they matter. This man is taking Spanish.
So we had, for Father's Day, we walked out of church and the weather was good. We went to the pavilion that's on the lawn there for outdoor stuff for kids. And we had pie. It was Pies for Pops or something like that. So my neighbor, who only speaks Spanish mostly, is eating a particular pie. And I'm over there looking up, how do you say pecan pie? And, you know, and so, and I practice it three times. I walk over and I say, is pecan pie your favorite pie?
In Spanish.
In Spanish.
Wow.
But I'd been practicing like 10 times over and over so it could just flow. And it was so fun that he lit up and he turned to me and he just launched in, well, yes, but then he started naming other pies he might like better. And I was like, sorry.
I'm in over my head at this point.
I have given the wrong impression. I can say pecan. And then he just left, but we bonded even over that. That was a fun thing.
It's really special. I honestly think the greatest gift we can give another human is letting them experience being seen and that they're known and that they matter. And that you practice 10 times, looked up on Google Translate or whatever app you're using, how to say pecan pie. Like, that gesture was really affirming for him.
No, then I had to follow in really a bad accent. I am learning with Duolingo. And that's what made him laugh. Like, oh, obviously.
Obviously. That's so great. That's really wonderful. I just think at the end of the day, at the end of the day and the beginning of the day, enabling others to know they're known and loved and matter is so valuable. And at the end of the day and the beginning of the day, I hope that is where faith traditions enable people to do that between themselves and God and themselves and their community. People should feel loved. Whether they're struggling with mental health issues or neurodiverse or have different disabilities, that people are loved for who they are.
Many thanks to Dr. Pamela Epstein King for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, Soraya Pearson, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Ashton Parkinson, and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. If interfaith understanding is important to you, be sure and leave a comment or review on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. It helps spread the word. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you'll join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith. Hi, this is Stephen Cap Perry, and I'd love to recommend one of our BYU Radio family of podcasts for you. It's called The Appleseed. It's filled with stories for you and your family. Every episode features really excellent, nationally known storytellers sharing all kinds of folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family stories. It's great to put on and listen to for road trips or bedtime for kids or anytime you want something to get the whole family not only listening, but then those stories generate conversations. And it's so easy to say, hey, do you have a story about this? Or, oh, that reminds me of when grandma said, or whatever it might be. Check out the Appleseed podcast. You'll have fun, and you might learn some new stories from your own family members.